The Destiny Foundation is proud to present this 5-tape series entitled The Crash Course in Jewish History, recorded live in Jerusalem, Israel by Rabbi Beryl Wein. The first tape, number 418, is Abraham to Ezra. We hope you enjoy.
This lecture series is entitled Crash Course in Jewish History, the whole story in 5 lectures. I have discovered that the problem with most crash courses is that they crash. And I don't know whether this is going to be an exception to that rule. But the idea behind the course was suggested to me by a number of people who wanted to have an overview of Jewish history, so to speak, without the details. So we'll see how it turns out. All of Jewish history is the history of people, and not necessarily of events or forces in the world. One of the great departures in the understanding of history in the modern era was the fact that Marx proposed the idea that history almost has nothing to do with people, but that there are certain forces in the human civilization, economic, social, political, that force events to occur, and that therefore people are only pawns. And this idea, which became a tenet of much of modern historiography, was based on the idea that the entire gamut of human experience really reflects impersonal patterns in the world, and that we are caught in the web, but we really do not direct it or control it. That idea is completely contrary to the Torah, and it's completely contrary to the Jewish view of things. The Jewish view of things is that everything depends upon individual people. Individual people have choices for good or for better, and that those choices bring about consequences, and those are the consequences that we call history. And therefore, in tonight's lecture, from Avraham to Ezra, we're basically going to talk about people. But because we talk about individuals, I think we'll see a pattern, and this pattern, I think, should be applied to all of Jewish history as well. The Chumash, the Torah itself, is not a history book per se. But on the other hand, there's a great deal of history that we can learn from it. The Jewish people begins over 3,700 years ago with one family, with a man and a woman, Avraham and Sarah. In fact, the prophet Isaiah, in one of his famous statements, says that if you want to understand where you come from, Habitu el Avraham avichem vel Sarah techolalchem. Look at the life of your father Avraham, your mother Sarah, who gave birth to you, and you'll get the picture, you'll get the pattern. One of the great problems in history is that you can know an enormous amount of facts but not get it, not understand what the pattern is. And in order to understand it, the Navi says, look at Avraham and Sarah. And he is expressing the idea that Chazal said, that the rabbi said over and over again, Ma'asei avos simon labonim. You want to understand what happens in the Jewish world at the end of the 20th century? You can do that by filtering today's events through the lives of our ancestors, through the events that have occurred to us over the century. Avraham and Sarah come from Mesopotamia, from Babylonia, and they come into a world that is entirely pagan. There are one or two or three exceptions. There are people like Shem and Aver, people that still have the tradition of Noah from the flood, but the world generally has been destroyed not by the flood, but by the generation after the flood, the Dor HaAfluga. The world is a tyrannical world. Nimrod is Stalin, Hitler. It's a world of technology over human beings. The rabbis phrased it elegantly that when a brick fell from the Tower of Babel, everybody wept and they said, oh, it's going to cost us so much money to get the brick back up. But if a human being fell off the scaffolding, they had plenty of human beings. That was not a problem. That attitude has not departed from mankind. It still exists. And Avraham comes into this world. According to Jewish tradition, he's born in the year 1948 after creation, after Adam. And there are different traditions, but I'm going to mention to you the idea that Maimonides says, the Rambam, that Avraham for the first 52 years of his life was also a pagan, because that was the society he was brought up in. Only when he was 52 years old did he come to the idea of monotheism by himself. Again, the rabbis expressed it. He looked at the world. One of the basic ideas of the Rambam, that everybody can be a believer on his own. God made it easy for us by revelation. But if there would be no revelation, there would have been no Maamar Har Sinai, we would still be obligated to discover God by ourselves. And we can do so through our bodies. Mitzori Echze Eloka, from my flesh I see God. The Rambam says you can do it through nature. You can look at the heavens. But because free will is so important in God's plan in the world, you can be the greatest scientist in the world and know every fact about nature and physics and be a non-believer, because otherwise free will wouldn't operate. But Avraham Avinu discovers God on his own, so to speak. And he and Sarah, who don't have an easy life, Avraham in the early part of his life is impoverished. Sarah is a barren woman. Avraham is taken and persecuted by Nimrod simply because he's different. He's thrown into the fire. And none of that appears in the Chumash. The Chumash, we would have thought that Avraham Avinu is tranquil. Nothing ever bothers them. Because the Chumash wants to impress us with what kind of a person he was. And what kind of a person our mother Sarah was. And we have patterns immediately established. And these are patterns that last. One pattern is Avraham is rootless all of his life. Never has a home. Always wandering. And throughout Jewish history, the Jewish people basically are rootless. And even when we settle somewhere, we're never happy where we're at. We always are looking for the next place. His bad joke, Jackie Mason, which is true, is that this man builds a $5 million home in Long Island, and he invites all of his friends to the housewarming, and the first thing he tells them when they come in to the door is, wait till you see the next one I build. There's an element of truth in that. Avraham is rootless. Lech lecha. He's always going. Avraham is alone in the world. Even when he is successful, and the Meiri, in his review of history, says that Avraham Avinu was successful, that almost half of civilization came to the idea of monotheism during his lifetime, but he's still alone. That's the word ha'ivri. That's why we're called Hebrews. So the historians have invented a tribe called the Habirus that no one else heard about. But the rabbi said, ha'ivri, we're called the Hebrews, is because we're on one side and everybody else is on the other side. So Jewish history means to be lonely, to be in few among the many. And the Torah will say that to us. Ki atem amat mikol ha'amim. You will be the least numerous of all nations. God did not choose us for numbers. Lo mirubchem. I did not choose you because I wanted a big people. God would have wanted a large people, he would have chosen the Chinese. So even today, if we look at the Jewish world, there are 13, maybe 14 million Jews came yerbu in the world today. In a world of over a billion Muslims, over a billion Christians, over a billion Buddhists, over a billion Confucian and Shintoists. So who are we? But look who we are. Look at the tumult. Look at the fact that you can't touch anything in the world without the Jews being there. God told us, you're going to be like your father, Abraham, your mother, Sarah. You're going to be alone. You're going to be rootless. But you're going to be the center of civilization. God also showed Avram that children don't always turn out the way you want them to turn out. And that that also would be true in Jewish life. That there would be no guarantees. Almost every one of the heroes that exist in the Bible, in the five books of Moses and in Nevi'im, almost every one of them has a family that causes them disappointment. Avraham, Yitzchak, and even though Yaakov barely escapes, but the story of Yosef and his brothers takes the life out of him. Moshe will have a grandson that will be a priest to Avodah Zarah. The kings of Israel and of Judah will have children that will be pagans and sinners. Almost no one has what in Yiddish we like to say is nachas. But nachas is a hard thing to come by. And unfortunately, almost ironically, even when you have it, you don't know that you have it. Because you've pushed the envelope further. And we don't see it. And yet, the Jewish people, Avraham and Sarah, produce Yitzchak. They also produce Yishmael. Avraham lives in a world where Sodom is the norm, not the exception. Avraham is the exception. The world is the world of Sodom. Mentioned many times that Sodom was not destroyed because it had 3 million evil people. It was destroyed because it did not have 10 good people. That's the lesson of Jewish history. A famous legend that there are 36 people that support the world, 36 righteous people. If you think you're one of them, you aren't. But it's individuals that preserve, because the world generally is a world of stone. It's murder and immorality and cruelty, war, violence. In our century, it's somewhat noteworthy, I think, that the century that began with a Balkans war is ending with the same Balkans war. As though the whole 160 million people that got killed in this century, nothing made an impression. Right back where we started from. Because the world is Sodom. And Avraham sees as his task, as the Jewish people have always seen as their task, the necessity of saving Sodom from itself. That was one, and it remains one of the great ideas of Judaism, of Torah, of Jewish people, is that we pray even for Sodom. We're going to save Sodom. We're going to get them the 10 good people. And we're not going to rejoice in their destruction. Because destruction, even when it is valid, does not advance the cause that the Lord wants mankind to achieve. Yitzchak and Rivka are as alone in their world as Avram and Sarah were in theirs. Everything that Avram achieved with the Philistines, with Avimelech, has to be done all over again. And Yitzchak and Rivka have a son, Esav, who is the bane of their existence. In their own house, the monster grows. And it is only through Yaakov that they have hope. But Yaakov, who becomes the symbol of all Jewish history. So Avram and Yitzchak were rootlessness. They were alone. But Yaakov becomes exile, servitude, being abused and exploited. Avraham, the nations of the world saying, the Si Elokim ato besocheinu. You're the prince of God. You're a great man. Yitzchak, you're a great man. They don't say that to Yaakov. They see Yaakov as a pauper, someone to take advantage of. And Yaakov attempts in his lifetime to walk the thin line, somehow to come to an accommodation with Lavan, to come to an accommodation with Esav, and to remain Yaakov. And because he is able to do so, so God changes his name. And God gives him the name of the Jewish people, the name of the land that we live in, the name of the state that we inhabit. Lo Yaakov yikore shimcha lo Yisrael. Now you're called Yisrael. Because Yisrael has the ability to live in a world of Esav, to live in a world of Lavan, and remain Yaakov. And that is a task that the Jewish people have also undertaken through our long history. When Martin Gilbert, in his book on the Holocaust, so among all of the anecdotes that he has, so he has an eyewitness tell a story that an SS soldier picked up a small Jewish child and threw him in a truck that was going to take him and the other children to their deaths. And the child told him, you know, you're Esav and I'm Yaakov. And even though you're going to kill me, I would still rather be Yaakov. That's Yisrael Yikore Shimcha. That's that ability to remain Yaakov in a world of Esav and Lavan. The Torah also tells us the pattern that the Jewish people are divisive. The Jewish people somehow are willing to argue, disagree, and then after a while mistrust each other and even turn brother against brother. For holy causes, and each of the sides is convinced that they're correct. Each of the sides is convinced that it's a mitzvah. The story of Yosef and his brothers is a story that has not ended until today. And we'll see that throughout the Tanakh it plays itself out. The competition between the tribe of Yehuda and the tribe of Yosef, between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judea, it never come to an accommodation. And because it's almost in the DNA, the story of Yosef and his brothers. And it's always, it's all, and I don't mean this sarcastically, it's always L'shem Shemayim, because Jews have a holy purpose. When you have a holy purpose and you know you're right, so then the other person has to be forced to see the justice of your position. And if you know you're right, then how can the other person be right? And that's what happens here. And Yaakov was powerless to prevent it. When Martin Gilbert, in his book on the Holocaust, so among all of the anecdotes that he has, so he has an eyewitness tell a story that an SS soldier picked up a small Jewish child and threw him in a truck that was going to take him and the other children to their deaths. And the child told him, you know, you're Esav and I'm Yaakov. And even though you're going to kill me, I would still rather be Yaakov. That's Yisrael Yikore Shimcha. That's that ability to remain Yaakov in a world of Esav and Lavan. The Torah also tells us the pattern that the Jewish people are divisive. The Jewish people somehow are willing to argue, disagree, and then after a while mistrust each other, and even turn brother against brother. for holy causes. And each of the sides is convinced that they're correct. Each of the sides is convinced that it's a mitzvah. The story of Yosef and his brothers is a story that has not ended until today. And we'll see that throughout the Tanakh it plays itself out. The competition between the tribe of Yehuda and the tribe of Yosef, between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judea, it never come to an accommodation. And because it's almost in the DNA, the story of Yosef and his brothers. And it's all, and I don't mean this sarcastically, it's always L'Shem Shemayim, because Jews have a holy purpose. When you have a holy purpose and you know you're right, so then the other person has to be forced to see the justice of your position. And if you know you're right, then how can the other person be right? And that's what happens here. And Yaakov was powerless to prevent it. Now the Lord promised Avraham that the Jewish people, his descendants, would undergo a process of being annealed in the furnace of slavery and exile, so that out of it would come a people that would be eternal, that would be so tough that nothing would destroy it. But because it's so tough, it's a tough people. Jewish people are very tough people. They're tough to deal with. If you have any doubts about it, stand in line at the Kupat Cholim. Today I had to stand in line and they ran out of numbers. Well, don't ask. No numbers. And you know, who's the last one? No, I'm the last one. I'm the last one, you know. So I said to the guy next to me, I said, you know, it's a good thing it's at the Kupat Cholim because they're going to beat each other up. So here they can get... They get treatment immediately. Tough people. Has to be a tough people. Otherwise you couldn't survive. Moshe said, I'm Ksheyoref, stiff-necked people, stubborn people. That's not all negative, that's positive. We wouldn't be stubborn, who would be? There wouldn't be anybody left. It's only the fact that we're stiff-necked. But on the other hand, it's a tough people. The Jewish people enter the exile of Egypt. So here also are patterns. Every exile begins well. Begins on a high note. The Jewish people come to Egypt. Joseph is the viceroy. The brothers are in Goshen. The Jewish people are doing swimmingly well. And then the Jewish people become super patriotic. When Paro calls for volunteers to work, all the Jews come to work because they're good Egyptians. And eventually the situation deteriorates. And the Jewish people become slaves. Now they were not the only slaves in Egypt. Egypt was a charnel house of slaves. Existed in the ancient world, even through the time of the Romans. As we'll discuss, it was a world of slavery. Slavery as an institution even existed in the United States until barely more than a century ago. But slavery itself is the most inefficient, inhuman, counterproductive way of building a civilization. And it's always built upon bigotry, and it's always built upon crushing the human spirit. Jews find themselves in Egypt. Our tradition tells us we're in Egypt for 210 years. Our tradition also tells us that it's only the last 86 years and that the real yoke of slavery was imposed upon the Jewish people. But then the Jewish people were destroyed. 80% of the Jews did not survive it. So when 3 million Jews left Egypt, 600,000 males between the age of 20 and 60, and if we'll extrapolate that to include the women and the children, those that were old and young, so we have a number of about 3 million. But 3 million was one-fifth of the Jewish world. And the other four-fifths were lost, which is also a pattern in Jewish history. I mentioned before that we're the smallest of all people. The time of the destruction of the temple, In the year 70, there were about 12.5-13 million Jews in the world, just about what there is today. The idiom that I always use is that there were about 6 million Chinese then. The Jews were twice the Chinese. The Chinese now, 2,000 years later, are 1,600,000,000. And we aren't. There's a constant hemorrhaging to the extent that there's Jewish blood almost everywhere in the world. 9 out of 10 Spaniards have Jewish blood in them. Throughout Europe, even Poland and Eastern Europe, where there was not that great an amount of an assimilation, nevertheless, the sizable amounts of Jews. I was struck when I visited Prague. My wife and I were in Prague, and we spoke to the guides. Everybody in Prague says that they can get their Jewish. There's only maybe 5,000 Jews in Prague, 1,500 in the Kahila, but they say there's at least 100,000 people in Prague who claim to be Jewish. We had a Jewish grandfather, a Jewish great-grandfather. And that's what happened to the Jews in Egypt. And Egypt was a place that no one ever escaped from. The Jews tried it. The tribe of Ephraim burst out of slavery, 30,000 strong. The Egyptians didn't even bother to try and bring them back because they knew they would die in the desert, which they did. And they are the dead, dry bones that the Novi Yecheskel prophesies about in the Haftorah that we read on Pesach. He couldn't get out of Egypt. 3 million people walked out one day on a Thursday. We know what day we left. We know that we stood at Sinai on a Shabbos. The Jewish collective memory remembers everything. And God took this people out, and they wandered in the desert for 40 days, and they were somehow sustained themselves miraculously. They had bread and water and food, and they were able to withstand all the vicissitudes of the desert. One of the great archaeological riddles is, where is Mount Sinai? I just saw an article that appeared in Vanity Fair that places Mount Sinai in the northwestern tip of the Saudi Arabian desert. So that Kriyas Yamsuf was across the Straits of Tehran, the entrance to the Red Sea. Maybe. But they've discovered this tremendous mountain that was once a volcano. And there's tremendous gold and all sorts of things around there. And the Saudis now have made it into a radar base. One of the most sophisticated radar bases in the Middle East. But the Jewish people existed. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says the point. He can't fool the Jewish people. The Jewish people by nature are skeptical. Even when something happens, they say it doesn't happen. We're skeptical. We're a skeptical people. Which is also one of our strengths. So he said, can you imagine somebody making up the story, inventing the story of Sinai? Somebody will come a generation later, or 2 generations later, or 3 generations later, and say, you know, you wandered in the desert for 40 years, and you came to a mountain, and God appeared, and he gave you a Torah, and it rained mon on you, and you know, there was a miraculous well. He says it would be ridiculous. The Jewish people never would have believed it if it hadn't happened, if they weren't eyewitnesses to it. They themselves were not part of it. And he says it's interesting that the tradition of Sinai exists amongst all religions in the world. He calls it consensus omnia. Everyone agrees, kuli alma lo plige, that that's where it began. The differences in the religions are what happens later. But everyone subscribes to Sinai. And God tells the Jewish people, I'm going to take you back to the land where Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov lived. Now, again, if it would be up to us, maybe we would have chosen a different land. Because the chosen land is not so chosen. A few days ago, the climate here was not comfortable. I don't think anybody moves to this country because of the climate. And it's a country that never has enough rain. It's a country that yields its bounty very, very sparingly and difficult. So if God wanted to take us to the chosen land, in the Chumash it says, I'm not taking you to Egypt. Egypt has the Nile. The Mephoshim say immediately, Egypt has the Nile, so nobody prays to God because you got the Nile, right? And so I'm going to bring you to this land. and the land is inhabited by others. It's not empty. And the others aren't going to give it to you. And even if you conquer it, you'll have a difficult time maintaining yourselves there. But that's where I want you to be. And I want you to have an attachment to that land. An attachment that will survive 1900 years of absence. Again, something that has never occurred in all of human history. That a people should be away from a land for 1900 years and come back and not only make it their land again, but feel at home in it, as though somehow they never left, and that this is their place. With all of the difficulties of living in this country, and there are many, and they should never be underestimated. But one thing I think that almost all Jews feel is that somehow there's a deja vu feeling. You know, I've been here before. I mean, that was the first feeling I had. The first time I came there to Israel, I got off the airplane, I never was here. But I had the feeling that somehow I had been here before. A feeling that I don't have when I went to San Antonio. So God said, I'm going to give you the land. And you're going to try and become a people in this land. So the first stage are individuals. The second stage is the slavery of Egypt. The third stage is that you're going to develop as a people in the desert. Now we're going to try the great experiment. We're going to try and make you an abnormal people in a normal situation. An abnormal mamleches kohanim goy kodosh, a holy people, but you're going to have to run a country. You're going to have a nation. You're going to have leaders and armies and taxes and lawyers, all the things that go with it. And that's the ultimate experiment. And that's the ultimate accomplishment that the Jewish people are able to do it.
This is the end of side one.
We've tried it twice and been unsuccessful. This is the third attempt. We pray that we will be successful, but it will take a great deal of effort and will also take some knowledge and experience as to why we were not successful the first two times. We learn another lesson that the Torah wants us to learn, and that is that the greatest and holiest of people are mortal. You have Moshe Rabbeinu, who goes to Sinai, brings down the Torah, Peel, Peah, Daber, Bo, speaks to God directly. There's nobody like Moshe ever. Lo kom bi Yisrael kamoshe od. Noviu mabitas tmunoso, that sees the countenance of God, so to speak. But the chasreyu mat melakim, it says in Tehillim, that refers to Moshe. Moshe is one level below. But Moshe dies. On Simchas Torah we have a piyut that we recite, but we recite it later in the day when everyone is already a little happy, so therefore not much attention is paid to the words. But it's a very somber piyut. It always makes an impression upon me. It's the Lithuanian in me. Moshe Meis Milo Yomus is the name of the piyut. Moshe died, who shall not die? Who is immortal? No one. And that's a lesson in history. Because of the many, many problems in history exist, and because people were not willing to accept the fact that everyone is mortal. And that's a lesson. Moshe is succeeded by Yoshua. So there's another lesson. Yoshua is not Moshe. People say, what kind of leader is this? We're used to better. Pnei Moshe ki pnei Chama, pnei Yoshua ki pnei Levona. Moshe is the sun, Yoshua is only the moon. It's the lesson. Every generation has its leaders. And to compare generations and leaders is unfair. It's also counterproductive. It does nothing for anyone. Yeshua conquers the country. He is still able to maintain the centrality of authority because people see him as a direct product of Moshe Rabbeinu. But when Yoshua dies, the Jewish people become shtiebelized. Everybody makes his own place. Then it becomes 12 tribes. Then I'm not interested in you, and you're not interested in me. I have my part of the country, you have your, you have trouble with your part, so that's your problem. I'm in good shape in my part. Not only that, the Jewish people so grow apart from each other that they mount a civil war, one against the other. 30,000 are killed in the war, Jew against Jew. An entire tribe, the tribe of Binyamin, is almost destroyed. And the Jewish people come in contact with a culture, the Canaanite culture. So it's one thing to be a good Jew in the desert. One thing to be a good Jew 40 years in the desert, nobody else is around. There's no civilization, no culture, nothing to compete with. So even then the Jews rebel. But that's just because they're rebelling. They're not being influenced. Now they come into a country that has a culture. And the culture is not negative. Culture has attractive forms to it. And a large proportion of the Jewish people give up. They become pagans. They lose sight of the vision. And they don't want to be a special people. And therefore, this is a recurring theme throughout Jewish history. And God always forces us back into the corner. God never allows that the Jewish people as a whole will leave. Individual Jews can quit, and Jewish people can never quit. Covenant is binding. So the Lord sends shoftim, he sends judges. And they represent different tribes. But they try to centralize the Jewish people, and they try to push them back towards the idea of the mission and the goal of the Jewish people. The entire period of the Shoftim, which is almost 400 years, was almost always a time of war. There are about 120 years that it says Vatishkot Oretz. One place it says Vatishkot Oretz Shmonim Shona, and by Dvorah it says Vatishkot Oretz Arboim Shona. It was quiet for 80 years, it was quiet for 40 years, but for the other centuries it never was quiet. You had it always going on. If you look over the history of the Jewish people in this country, a very, very small percentage of the time has it been quiet. And the country is under constant attack. The Plishtim are here, the Canaanim are here, the Phoenicians are here, and the country finds itself between two great empires, a situation which would persist almost till our day. The southern empire is Egypt. The northern empire will be either Assyria or Babylonia, Mesopotamia, Iraq. And the meeting point of the empires is here in this small country. And the Jews are always subjected to this problem, that both empires are determined to control them and are willing to conquer them. And it becomes a balancing act again. To go back to what I said originally, it's how to be Yaakov in a world of Esav and Lavan. How to be Yaakov in a world of Paro and Saddam Hussein. Finally, the great prophet Shmuel, who marks the end of the period of the Shoftim, arises. And Shmuel again centralizes the Jewish people. Our rabbis tell us that if you make a list, you know, so after Moshe and Yoshua, you have to put Shmuel. And the Jewish people now become a monarchy. Strong kings are necessary. Because otherwise, again, the Jewish people will tear themselves apart. And they will be unable to survive the outside and internal pressures. The first king, Shaul HaMelech, would have won the election 99% to 1. Shaul is the perfect king. Ben Shona Shaul B'molcho. He's free of sin as a one-year-old child. No one has a bad word to say about him. He's the tallest of the Jews. He's the handsomest. He's the bravest. He's the Talmud Chochem. He's the perfect king, except he isn't. There's a lesson there, too. The lesson, again, as Chazal phrase it, you should never appoint a leader that does not have skeletons in the closet. Thank God we have passed that test. We are not looking for perfect leaders. Perfect leaders are not what the Torah wants for us. Different matter completely. I always tell the story of the dean in my yeshiva that the most pious boy in our class, he refused to give him smicha because he said that he didn't feel that he was worthy of it or that he could be a rabbi. And his mother came to the dean to plead the boy's case. And she said, you know, he's the most pious boy in the class. And the dean said to him, for piety, you get the world to come, not smicha. And there's a lot of truth to that. It's two different things. Shol bankrupts. It's a disaster. But Shmuel is told to find the other king. The other king is most unlikely. He's short and he's ruddy. His brothers don't have a high opinion of him. He's a shepherd. He wastes his time playing the guitar. God says, he's the king. You'll see, he'll make it. And David becomes the king. And even though the Tanakh has harsh things to say about David, but David is Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayam. When we think in terms of leadership, we think in terms of David. We think in terms of the Messiah, Ben David Bo. When we think in terms of prayer, David is the one that composed the greatest prayer book in human history, the Tehillim. Ne'im Zmiros Yisrael, the songster of Israel. The person with the magic harp. The person that rose above all personal and national tragedies. Because he had the vision. He got it. He understood what the problem was. And he kept the Jewish people as Yaakov. And he was strong enough to fight Esav on Esav's terms and wily enough to best Lavan on Lavan's terms. David has a son, Shlomo, from his marriage to Bathsheba, which itself is a problem. And Shlomo is the wisest of all people. So again, we think we have the perfect monarch, the wisest, most clever of all people. And he builds the Beis Hamikdash, he builds the temple. And the Jewish monarchy reaches the zenith, the high point of its existence. And the land is quiet, there's 40 years of peace, there's prosperity, the Shekhinah is here, the city of Jerusalem is built, the temple is constructed on Har HaMoriah, but Shlomo also cannot maintain it. Too wise. So again, our rabbis say that anybody that is too, T-O-O, has got a problem. Too rich, too poor, too smart, too dumb, too handsome, too beautiful. Anything that's too is a problem. Because people find it hard to handle. So he said, I'm above the law. I'm above the Torah. The Torah says not to have too many horses, that's for the regular king. I can have as many as I want. The Torah says not the king shouldn't acquire too great wealth, that's for the regular kings, but not for me. Too many wives, that's not, I can have as many as I want. And it begins to unravel. So that by the end of his reign, the centrality of the Jewish government is again threatened. We're going to revert back to the time of the Shofti. Except that now there are going to be two major kingdoms. Because there reawakens within the Jewish people the split between Yosef and Yehuda. Between Yosef and his brothers. And there's a great man, Yerovam ben Nevot. The Talmud says was the greatest Talmud Chochem of his time. And he was crowned as king by the great prophet Ahiah HaShiloni. Ahiah HaShiloni lived for hundreds and hundreds of years. According to the Medrash, he left Egypt, and he was the Rebbe of Eliyahu HaNovi. So between Ahiah and Eliyahu, all of Jewish, what says, Niskapel es Olam, the entire world is covered because Elio is still around. And Yeruvim had the opportunity. And he broke away upon the death of Shlomo. And he formed the northern kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes. And Shlomo's son, Rechavam, was left here in Yerushalayim with the tribe of Yehuda and partially the tribe of Binyamin. But it was a chance at reconciliation. It was a chance to put it together. But both sides, both leaders made terrible errors. The Jewish people said to Rechavam that we don't want a dictator. We don't want someone that will be so evil to us. We want someone that will treat us nicely and with respect, that will lower the tariffs and the taxes. The Rechavam said, I'll give you an answer. And the Tanakh, he went and he asked the elders what to do. The elders said, you have to come to an accommodation with the people. Then he went and he asked the young people what to do. The young people said, shove it to them. Show them who's boss. Chutzpah that they ask you. So the rabbi said, the rule that if you listen to the young against the old, you're making a mistake. So he gave them the wrong answer. Now Yeruvim had a chance. But Yeruvim is so consumed with jealousy that he purposely erects a wall, the original Berlin Wall, here at Beit El. And he does not allow the Jews from the northern part of the country to come to Jerusalem, to come to worship at the temple. Because he knows the halacha that in the precincts of the temple, only the king of the house of David was allowed to sit on a chair. Everyone else would have to stand. And therefore, if they came to the temple, they would see that their king was standing while Rechavam was sitting. He could not bear that. So you'll say, but you know, such a great policy decision that affects generations should be influenced by such a petty matter. Well, if you say that, then you don't know human beings. Almost all great events are petty matters. Many a terrible war that has cost thousands and thousands of lives was started over a petty matter, over an insult imagined. And therefore Yeruvim says we're going to have a new religion. So we made a strange religion, the Mephorshim tell us. They kept the Shabbos, they kept Kashrus, they kept all the mitzvahs, except they worshipped idols. So they had a frum of Avodah Zorah. Reb Reuven Margolius, in one of his great Svarim, has a long essay showing how the northern kingdom lived. So they didn't live as non-Jews, they lived as Jews, except that they worshipped Avodah Zorah. And the culture of Avodah Zorah got to them. All of the kings of the northern kingdom, all of them were sinners. None of them had the courage to break away. None of them, even though many of them knew, even though many of them were crowned by prophets, and before they became the king, they had a platform that they were going to destroy idolatry. When they became the king, none of them were able to do so. So in the year 732, before the Common Era, after numerous warnings from the prophets, the Jewish people didn't believe that God would ever do anything to them because they said God has got too much invested with them. It was mentioned that, you know, if you're going to borrow money from a bank, borrow a lot of money. If you only borrow $1,000 and you don't pay them back, they'll come after you. They'll garnish your wages. They'll do everything. But if you borrow $100 million from them, and you're late in the payment, they'll call you up very nicely and see how they can work it out with you. Because you're into them too deeply for them just to pull the rug. Well, the same thing, the Jewish people felt that God was, they were into God, so to speak, too deeply. God had invested his name, his Torah, his land, his temple. What's he going to do? He's stuck. So we can do whatever we want. The prophet said that's a terrible error. God is God without the people, without the Torah, without the temple, without the land. He doesn't need you. You need him. And God proved it. Sanherib came in 732 before the Common Era, and he took the Jewish people into exile. The 10 northern tribes disappeared off the face of the earth. Where are they? Well, most of them moved south to Judea and became part of the tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin. But large sections of them disappeared completely. Legend has them living behind the magical river somewhere. But the Talmud's opinion is that they're never coming back. Gone. And instead, a new people, the Shomronim, the Samaritans, came and inhabited the northern part of the country. The people of Judea took it to heart, but they only took it to heart for a certain period of time. And then they themselves also fell victim to bad leadership and to the fact that somehow they felt that nothing would ever happen to them. And finally, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, descended, destroyed Jerusalem, burnt the temple to the ground. 90% of the Jews were taken into the exile of Babylonia. 10% went with the Novi Yirmiya into exile in Egypt. The Jewish nation was over. The Jewish country was ravaged and ruined. There was no future. What was the reaction of the Jews to that? Well, a certain section of the Jews in Babel came to the Novi and they said, well, if God did that, then we quit. We're not responsible. K'chol ha-goyim beis Yisrael. We're like everyone else. We're going to be Babylonians. God said, no. Hoyolosia dover hazeh. Oh, no. The Jewish people can never quit on me. And then we have the story of Purim, where Haman proved that you couldn't quit. Haman was looking for every Jew. Didn't make a difference. I'm Mordechai. He's not just looking to kill Mordechai, because Mordechai has a big black hat and curls and funny looking. He's out to get them all. The professors, the doctors, the diplomats, the bankers. I'm Mordechai. Everybody he wants. And Jewish people are saved. The story of Purim, which happened 52 years after the destruction of the first temple. And Jewish people are saved miraculously. Again, by a fluky story, Beis Yaakov girl wins beauty prize, right? Miss Universe. Couldn't invent a story like that. And the Jewish people all of a sudden caught on. And Purim becomes the second Kabbalah Satorah, the second acceptance of the Torah. Kimu v'kiblu ayudim aleim, aleim valzaron. The Jewish people accepted. Yes, there's a covenant and we're part of it. We agree that we can't quit. 18 years later, a descendant of Queen Esther will give permission to the Jews to return to the land of Israel. And the second attempt at being Yaakov in a world of Lavan and Esav will begin. This time under the leadership of one of the greatest men in Jewish history, Ezra. Now, rabbis tell us if the Torah was not given through Moshe, it would have been given through Ezra. And so we'll talk about how that developed and the idea of the Second Commonwealth and the Second Temple and the experiences, again, of the Jewish people.
This concludes tape number 418, Abraham to Ezra, by Rabbi Beryl Wein.
For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346, or at our 24-hour fax number, 845-356-7733. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com or online at rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture except through the Destiny Foundation.